Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Wow. I like that. That's nice and engaged. I think it's probably the first time in a long time I've said good morning, everyone. Everyone's going, good morning. I like it. You can all come again, very definitely. So thank you for coming to this event about the importance of sleep. The reason we're running it, first of all, is it's World Sleep Day on Friday. Unfortunately, for diary reasons, we couldn't actually get this session in on Friday. But just so you're all aware, you know, if any of you are doing things within your organisations, or any of you want to, very last minute, do anything within your organisations, then Friday is World Sleep Day. It is Friday, isn't it?
Yes,
it is Friday. For those of you that don't know me, my name is David Regan. I'm a senior associate in the Labour and Employment team here at Squire Patton Ball. I have very little to do with sleep, primarily because I have a small child who this morning decided to wake me at 4:30. Just because, and my wife is also pregnant with our second, so she had been repeatedly kicking me in the night because apparently I shuffle my feet and snore, and that's not great to be pregnant. A few housekeeping things. We do have a fire alarm drill today, but it's not until 11 o'clock. We really hope, as much as we've enjoyed your company, that we are done by 11. So if we do hear a fire alarm in the interim, it's probably going to mean we do need to exit. We just need to walk back down towards the lift and towards the toilet, and then halfway down the corridor there's a fire exit. We'll help you down. Unlikely to happen. If anyone does need to take a break partway through, then again the bathrooms are back down the corridor on the left hand side. So why sleep? I'll be honest, until it was raised as an issue with me, it's not something I particularly thought of. I'd probably get anywhere between 7 to 8 hours of sleep. If I'm lucky, sometimes a little bit less. Yes, you feel tired at work, and you realise you're not fully on it if you're tired, but we all drink a lot of coffee, or we drink lots of other probably healthier drinks and try and stay awake, try and eat healthily, etc. We were approached by Corporation of London's Business Healthy Unit about a year ago, and they said, would you like to do a webinar with Marcus and Leon, who I'll talk about in a minute, about sleep? I thought, that's really interesting. How is that even remotely a legal issue or potentially an HR issue? But then the more I looked into it, the more you find out about the lost cost of productivity, which Marco will talk about in a little bit. We have a Marco and a Marcus, just to let you know. It's slightly confusing. And then, obviously, there's all sorts of health and safety issues in it as well. So we didn't have an awful lot of uptake within people within the employment team to come and talk about it or even to attend the seminar, because most of us are actually, frankly, far too scared to hear just how unproductive we are after a good night's sleep, after a lack of a good night's sleep. But today, we do have to talk us through it. First of all, Marco Hatton. Marco is an economist at the RAND Corporation, and he was a co-author of a very wide-ranging report on the economic costs and impact of sleep, which has been quoted very widely in the Financial Times, all sorts of other places. We also have Marcus de Grignon, who's the Managing Director of the Third Pillar of Health. After a career in banking, Marcus has then moved into the health and wellbeing side, and he now runs Third Pillar of Health, which looks at specifically sleep issues in businesses. He's worked with TfL, Diageo, Oracle, Lendlease, so lots of different big businesses who are looking at the impact of sleep on their employee population. And last but definitely not least, we have Rob Elvin, who is the head of our health and safety team. Rob's got huge experience in all health and safety matters, so prosecutions, investigations, and all the little things that can trip a business up. And he's going to talk about some of the significant health and safety prosecutions that he's seen in the past that do actually have fatigue as a major element. So that's enough from me, and I'm going to hand over to Mark now to talk about the economics.
Thank you, David.
Sorry, actually, one final point which I completely forgot to mention. We are actually recording today's session to play back afterwards. So if you want to say anything mean about this, make sure you say it under your breath, because it could be on the recording. But otherwise, if you do ask a question, we'll repeat it back to you so it's then there on the recording and everyone can hear it.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to talk today about our research I've conducted at RAND Europe about the economic cost of insufficient sleep and why sleep matters more widely for our society. So as David said, I'm a senior economist at RAND, or RAND Europe, which is a not-for-profit research organization, which has the mission to improve policy and decision-making through research and analysis. And we are based in Cambridge, UK. We also have an office in Brussels, and our main offices are in the United States and Washington. And within RAND, we conduct research projects together with Vitality, the health insurance. You might have seen all the ads with the dog that tries to nudge you to be more healthy and do more exercise. And within that, we have this project called Britain's Healthiest Workplace, which I think now is probably one of the largest annual surveys on health and well-being in the workplace, where on an annual basis we conduct a survey with companies, about 100, and subsequently do a health assessment with the employees, where each year we have about 30,000 to 40,000 UK employees, which gives us a lot of information about their health, their well-being, their lifestyle, their demographics, and so on. And among many other things and information they give us, they also tell us about their sleep behavior, so how long they sleep, and the sleep quality. And part of this is feeding in this research I'm presenting to you today. So to come back to sleep, among healthy nutrition, exercise, sleep is often referred to as the third pillar of health. But as you may agree with me, it's often the pillar of health that we most often neglect compared to the others. And this, according to a lot of research, has negative consequences for your physical, your mental health, but also for your cognitive function and performance. So for instance, we know that insufficient sleep, and probably from your own personal experience, insufficient sleep impairs your ability to perform tasks on a daily basis, at home and at work. It makes your cognitive function get worse. You might forget things, you might be moody, and so on. So this is all what happens in the short run if you don't sleep enough. In the long run, we know that if you don't sleep enough chronically on a long period of time, that can actually be associated with the onset of dementia, because we know that during sleep, your brain clears out toxins that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. But also, insufficient sleep makes you more vulnerable to common infections, such as the common cold or the flu. And we also know that insufficient sleep is associated with chronic health conditions, such as diabetes, stroke, heart disease, and cancer in the long run. We also know that insufficient sleep puts your mental health in jeopardy. So a lack of sleep is associated with virtually every known mental health condition we know, from depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and even suicide ideation. And we know that skimping out on too many nights of sleep also negatively affects your ability to perform routine tasks that require vigilance, such as driving a car. And for instance, we know that if you sleep less than 5 hours a night for two consecutive nights, that can actually make an otherwise healthy person to function as if it's legally drunk. The huge negative consequences from insufficient sleep, but I think Marcus will talk about this in a little bit more detail. And against this background, among all these negative health consequences, the US CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, which is the equivalent of Public Health England, declared that 1 in 3 Americans don't sleep enough, declared insufficient sleep as a public health epidemic. Now you think, well, it's just a problem of the Americans, but it's actually not. The insufficient sleep among the global population is an increasing problem, and it needs to be addressed. And as we know a lot about the economic consequences of chronic conditions such as cancer, dementia, mental health, not much was known before this study about the economic cost of insufficient sleep. And the richest gap around Europe, we published a report on the economic cost of insufficient sleep. It came out at the end of 2016. And funnily enough, the research idea for this report came from my own personal experience in my own family. So I'm an economist by trade, and as economists, you usually try to understand the impact of the behaviors you do during the 2 years of your life when you're away. So you go to work, you consume, you save, you invest. But then, I had children. And as many other parents of newborns, I immediately started to realize that sleep, or better, lack of sleep, really has an effect on your health, your well-being, and your productivity. So something I felt for the working day, so I live in St. Albans, I work in Cambridge, it's about a 1 hour drive. There have been days where I didn't understand how I actually came to the office while driving, which is very dangerous. While I was in the office, I wasn't really functioning to the best of my ability. I was really tired. I couldn't really focus. I couldn't concentrate. Over time, I gained a lot of weight because I just was too tired to do any exercise. And I became very moody. So, and at the end of a long period of having small children, the espresso machine literally became my best friend. So after like 10 espressos a day, I just thought like this is a little bit too much. And against this background and my own personal experience, and knowing that many millions of people worldwide don't sleep enough, I wanted to understand what all these effects of insufficiency mean in the big picture. So how all these effects come together in terms of insufficiency from the health and productivity side, how big is this problem in economic terms, and does insufficiency only affect your health, or does it actually also affect your work and your productivity? So we really wanted to deep dive into those specific questions. And this study was really the first to try to illuminate the link between insufficient sleep and cumulative economic loss for national economy. What we found from the research was really stark, and we find that insufficient sleep is associated with profound economic losses for 5 of the biggest economies in the world. So for instance, the United States loses on average per year about $411 billion just because the population doesn't sleep enough. And that's roughly about twice the annual revenue of the technology firm Apple, which corresponds to about 2.3% of its global GDP. In relative terms, Japan has sustained the biggest losses, about 2.9% of its GDP, which corresponds to about $138 billion annually. And as you can see from the slides behind me, the other three countries that we looked at, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Germany, also have quite substantial economic losses due to their populations not sleeping enough. So for instance, the United Kingdom loses on an annual basis about $50 billion, which is roughly about 1.9% of its GDP, and Germany roughly $60 billion a year, which corresponds to about 1.6% of its GDP. Now these numbers paint a bleak picture. So people don't sleep enough, that affects their health and productivity, but actually our study also has some positive aspects on it. So for instance, we find that small changes could already make a big difference. So for instance, if people who sleep less than 6 hours a night now, which is really kind of the threshold where all the risk factors start to kick in from insufficient sleep, began to sleep somewhere between 6 to 7 hours a night, this could already add billions to national economy. For instance, this could add, on an annual basis, about $226 billion to the US economy, roughly about $34 billion US dollars to the German economy, and roughly about $30 billion to the UK economy. And now you might think, how on earth did they come up with these numbers? And to that end, we built an innovative macroeconomic model that tries to mimic the behavior of real age within an economy, like households, companies, and the government. And within this model, age is basically just as reality. At some point in life, they go to school, they go to work, they consume, they save money, they invest, and at some point in their life, they retire. So you can think about this model similar to what the Asian Treasury uses for the economic policy analysis, a similar kind of model, where first we run a forecast on how the economy could progress over the next year, and then we run counterfactual scenarios and say, okay, we know all these negative effects of insufficient sleep. How would actually the economy change differently over time if people would change their sleep behavior and begin to sleep more? And within this model, insufficient sleep could affect in many different ways your life and work status and productivity, but we specifically focus on three effects. And the first one is mortality. So our meta-analysis shows that people who regularly sleep less than 6 hours a night or a day have a 13% greater chance of dying at any given point in time and at any given point in their life than people who sleep between 7 and 9 hours, which is usually the recommended hours of sleep that you should get according to medical associations. Now, interestingly enough, even if it's people who die prematurely because they for instance have a car accident, or in the long run they might get chronic health conditions because they don't sleep enough, such as cancer, stroke, and heart disease, even if these people get replaced, productivity can suffer. So think about last time you started a new job, it's usually impossible to be as up to speed at the very beginning and later on when you're longer in the job. The second effect we look at is workplace productivity, and unsurprisingly, our study finds that insufficient sleep is associated with lower levels of productivity in the workplace. And this is mainly driven by two factors. The first one is absenteeism, so if people don't show up at work, or if people show up at work but don't function to the best of their ability. So basically, that is me after having kids at work, literally just sleeping instead of having any chance to do some productive work. And now what we find is that those individuals or employees who sleep less than 6 hours a night are about 2.4% less productive than those in the healthy sleep range. So what that means, translated into things like long days a year, is 2.4% translated into 7 full days a year that an employee who sleeps less than 6 hours a night compared to someone who sleeps 7 to 9 hours a night loses on an annual basis just because he doesn't really function to his best of ability or is more likely sick. Those things are the common flu, common cold or flu, as we mentioned earlier. And we find that each year, a large number of working days in the 5 economies that we looked at are lost due to insufficient sleep. Now, the first factor we looked at is suboptimal flu performance in young years, according to insufficient sleep, which hinders the development of children and young adults. For instance, there are a lot of studies who show that insufficient sleep as a teenager or as a child has a negative effect on your concentration, it has a negative effect subsequently on the grades that you get, and even the qualifications you achieve. And in the long run, this can have a negative effect on your future financial earnings and subsequently a negative effect on the economy as well. And you might have seen recently some BBC Panorama episodes where they show that there is like now a sleep epidemic among young children already because they spend just 1 hour or just shortly before they go to bed on iPads and so on, which has a really detrimental effect on their sleep. Now, to come to the drivers of insufficient sleep that we found on the data that we found in the Healthy Workplace Project, we find a couple of factors which are really associated with sleep duration. The thing we find that people who have a BMI, which is classified as obese, on average, per night, they sleep 7 minutes less than someone in the healthy BMI range. We find that smoking is negatively associated with sleep duration. So on average, smokers sleep 5 minutes less than a non-smoker per night. For instance, if you drink an excessive amount of sugary drinks, which is any drink, energy drinks that have a negative effect on sleep duration, a lack of physical activity, the people who do less than 120 minutes of physical activity a week sleep about, on average, 2.6 minutes less than someone who does the healthy kind of sleep range, healthy exercise range. Not surprisingly, mental health problems are associated with insufficient sleep. Here, the problem is causality. So we know if you don't sleep enough, in the long run, you might develop mental health problems, but also if you already have mental health problems, your sleep might suffer. Then financial concerns is a major driver. So people who say that they have financial concerns due to various reasons, sleep on average 10 minutes less. Dependent children, we all heard that, also from our own perspective. And then a very important driver is unrelated time pressures or stress at work. So people who say they have stress at work sleep on average 8 minutes less than people per night, than people who say they don't have stress. And another important factor is commuting. So we find that people who commute more than 60 minutes one way to work sleep on average 16.5 minutes per night less than people who commute only between 0 to 30 minutes. Now you think that doesn't sound much, it's a couple of minutes, but you need to understand that these are all the individual effects that add up. So this is literally adjusted for everything else. So to give you an example, we have an employee who smokes, consumes 2 energy drinks a day, doesn't do enough exercise, has financial concerns because his mortgage is a bit high, he has dependent children, and he has stress at work, and like me, he commutes 60 minutes one way. So this adds up to 60 minutes a night that this person sleeps less than someone who doesn't have this risk factor. That's a night. So per week, let's say 5 working days, is about 250 minutes a week. And if you count it up over the year, you might lose about 200 hours of sleep just because of those risk factors that you could easily mitigate. So it doesn't look that much on this slide, but actually to sum it up, it's quite a substantial sleep loss that you might get over a full year. Now, our report also gives some recommendations. So on three levels, the first is the individual level. Obviously, there are a lot of factors you can do to improve your sleep and your sleep, sleep hygiene and your sleep behavior. One important factor that is always mentioned is limiting use of electronic devices around an hour before you go to sleep, because we know that those devices like smartphones or tablets expose you to so-called blue light, which has been found to really hinder or impair the production of a sleep hormone melatonin, which makes you makes you every night feel tired. And if you use electronic devices just before you go to bed, that really impairs the production of this very important hormone. Obviously, as I said, other factors, maybe stop smoking. If you're a smoker, do regular exercise. These are all factors that you can do as an individual to potentially sleep better and get more sleep, and also look at your diet, for instance. On the corporate level, very important. So we find that, you know, as a company, it's very important to create a culture where people or employees feel that sleep is actually something important. So for instance, if you have a CEO of the company who publicly claims that he only sleeps 2 hours a night, you as an employee probably think that part of the culture, though, shouldn't. Sleep is not that important. So there's a lot of things that companies can do. They could also promote healthy sleep behavior. As I say, here often a line manager is very important. So we find that a line manager has a very important function to be a role model and tell his employees that, you know, that they should look after themselves and probably also look after their sleep. If he finds that people have problems concentrating, they don't really function, their productivity goes down, maybe as a line manager should try to understand what's going on and maybe also give them some recommendations on maybe sleeping more. And obviously we have seen a lot of things that companies like Google and so on do. They provide sleep pods and nap pods where people can take a nap in the afternoon. It doesn't always have to be like very fancy stuff, but for instance, if you, as a company, you introduce health and well-being initiatives such as, you know, regular exercise, giving people access to gym, that also has an effect on potentially in the long run of improving sleep, as we found, because exercise has a positive effect on sleep duration, sleep quality. And then on the more kind of public authority level, we find that information campaigns can help. And interestingly, you might have seen that Public Health England just published together with Visit in the Community sleep and recovery toolkit that gives a lot of recommendations for employers what they can do in terms of improving the sleep behavior of individuals. And we also know that the WHO is actually taking sleep way more seriously than in the past, and they will potentially come up with their own campaign in the future, what we heard. As David said, this report got a lot of media attention, mainly with the BBC, I think, because all the journalists are very sleep deprived, so they really lost the story of this report, obviously also taking into account all the negative messages that came out in terms of mortality and loss of productivity, as you mentioned, the Financial Times, and also the New York Times, made in the Sunday edition, had a special edition that, which mainly on findings of this report, also saying now that sleep is the status symbol. So there's currently momentum going on that sleep is a very important health factor that shouldn't be neglected. Elsewhere, public sleep advocate Ariana Huffington, the founder of the Huffington Post, uses the findings of this report, especially the economic numbers, on many public speeches that she gives. And here the gentleman on right or left, depending on where you see from, this is Matthew Walker. He wrote this book, published I think last year, Why We Sleep, international bestseller. If you only want to read one book this year, I really strongly recommend this. And it also has at least one paragraph dedicated to the findings of this study. So this is a really good book, I can only recommend. Like, basically summarize all the evidence that we know about all the factors of sleep and how it affects our lives and our productivity and health. And also, based on this project and with Healthy Workplace, we're in contact with a lot of employers who ask us what can we do in terms of improving the sleep behavior of our employees. And some of them have taken recommendations on board, such as providing our amenities or facilities where people can take a nap in the afternoon, or start thinking about how they can implement sleep training for employees, which helps improving the sleep hygiene of people. And now, if I haven't put you to sleep yet, and actually even if you fell asleep, I take it as a badge of honor because I know it's very good for your health. I just wanted to conclude that improving individual sleep individual sleep behavior is good for your health, but it also can improve your productivity at work and also could subsequently improve the bottom line of the company, which is basically a win-win all around. And I'll pass on to Mark.
Good morning, all. My name is Mark Istegangle, and as David very kindly said, I represent Third Crew of Health. So we've worked with a number of companies over a long period of time to kind of look at, I guess, sleep and health. But what I guess my role today is to have a look at kind of some of the big picture around sleep, delve into some of the details around the health and productivity perspective, which is why David's colleagues are here. And then finally look at, I guess, some of the findings that we've come across in the work that we've done with a number of organisations. So, what's the problem? Well, essentially, you know, lots of organisations already run some pretty good health and wellbeing programmes. Some of them, I guess, are a little bit more ad hoc, some are more strategically based. However, the growing sleep deprivation epidemic, which I'll look at in a bit more detail, means that, you know, this can really impact on the effectiveness of what is already being done in an organisation and potentially may not be the best or interventions currently being run might not necessarily be the best interventions for that group. The issue is that actually, in reality, quite often the member of staff and certainly in the organisation have very little idea of what the impact is on the productivity, performance and safety record in the organisation. So why is sleep important? Well, I think Mark has covered quite a lot of this, but obviously, you know, together with cardiovascular fitness and nutrition, you know, we suggest these are the three pillars of health. Sufficient good quality sleep is vital to keeping us healthy and productive. With sufficient sleep, we're obviously more energetic, we're healthier, we're more successful, and we're generally a lot happier. And sleep plays a major role in preparing the body and mind for a psychologically and physiologically healthy tomorrow. So if we give ourselves the chance to get enough sleep, that actually has a tremendous amount of benefits. It obviously helps us to restore and rejuvenate. It's not just the body, it's also the mind. Our energy, our alertness, our productivity all increase, as does our mood and our perception. Our weight also is regulated as we sleep as well, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. Our memory, our learning, our creativity and our thinking are all improved. And ultimately, obviously, for those that work in safety critical industries, so is the safety of our staff. So that's a positive, but what happens if we don't get enough sleep? Well, it's obviously fairly obvious. We've all experienced bad night of sleep probably at some point. So we get that daytime drowsiness and we get the temporary loss of energy, especially in the afternoon dip or if we're doing something slightly more mundane. More seriously than that is these micro sleeps or sleep seizures. So these can last from a fraction of a second up to potentially 2 seconds. So if you're travelling along in a car on a motorway, you might potentially cover 50, 60 metres without any real control of that car. So anyone in a safety critical setting, that's obviously quite an issue. We do suffer these mood shifts. So it's, you know, it might just be increased irritability, we might lose our sense of humour, and on a longer term basis, as Mark pointed out, we could also suffer much more serious mental health issues as well. We're also much more likely to suffer stress, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We lose our interest in socialising. The reason we gain weight is there's a couple of different factors. So the first one is there are two hormones that are regulated when we sleep. So one is called ghrelin and the other one is called leptin. And these two hormones have two effects. So one regulates our appetite and the other one regulates our feelings of fullness. So if those hormones are out of whack, what's going to happen is we're going to eat more often and more each setting as well. And also research has shown that you eat between 300 and 500 calories the night or extra after a bad night of sleep. And that tends to be in that sort of junk food. So we'll reach for the sticky bun, the chocolate, Coke, whatever else it might be. So it tends to be very poor quality foods that we reach for, just to give us that lift. And we also suffer from reduced immunity as the immune system stops functioning so well. So, obvious question is, are we getting enough sleep? And I think it's been reasonably well proven that the answer is no. And as Mark has said, the Centers for Disease Control has called sleep deprivation a public health issue, and it's actually just overtaken obesity in America as the greatest health issue facing the country. The National Sleep Foundation found that even in the relatively short period between 1999 and 2010, those who were sleeping for less than the recommended 7 hours a night rose from 34% to 46% of the population. And recent studies here in the UK have shown that up to 75% of the population are now not achieving a healthy amount of sleep. And Warwick University have done numerous studies, and they suggest that at any one time, 20% of people across the developed world might be suffering from sleep problems. So quite often that would be 10 to 15% in a chronic state, and maybe 5 to 10% in a sort of transitional state as well. So what is the impact? And let's look at the individual first. So just to expand on, I guess, some of the things that Marco covered. So sleeping for less than 6 hours a night increases our risk of obesity by 23% versus 7 to 8 hour sleepers. That rises to 50% in those getting 5 hours of sleep and 73% in those getting just 4 hours of sleep a night. Boston University Medical School showed that sleeping for 5 hours a night increased our risk of diabetes by 2.5 times. Versus 7 to 8 hour sleepers. And UCL and Warwick did a study on 10,000 civil servants here in the UK, and what they showed is that reducing sleep time from 7 to 5 hours a night doubled our risk of dying of heart disease. There's also been a number of studies on sleep deprivation and increased risk of certain cancers. We know that shift workers are more prone to health issues, but also lower sleep durations, and there's a correlation as well in terms of shift working, poor sleep and poor health. But it's not just these chronic conditions, you know, so it is the coughs, the colds, the stuff that's going around the last few weeks, the flus, whatever, all that sort of stuff. So California University showed that sleeping less than 6 hours a night increased our risk of catching a cold by 4 times versus those getting 7 or more hours of sleep a night. So not just obviously the health, if you're feeling bad enough, but it's also you know, our performance and our safety. I think Mark has covered off the first point. So Pennsylvania University did a study. So they got a group of volunteers, split them into 3 different groups. So, and they covered them over a 2-week period. So what they did is they sat them in front of these computers, fairly standard cognition and alertness tests that you kind of see all over sleep labs. And over the course of the 2 weeks, they sort of, you know, they tested them several times a day. One group was allowed to sleep kind of 7 to 9 hours, whatever they were normally, you know, so these were all healthy sleepers at the beginning of the experiment. So they were allowed to sleep kind of, you know, normal length of time. Another group was restricted to just 6 hours of sleep a night. And a third group was allowed just 4 hours of sleep a night. So they monitored them again all through these 2-week period. And by the time they got to the end of that 2 weeks, the guys in the group that were allowed to sleep at kind of normal level had managed to maintain their performance throughout the experiment. Those that had been restricted to just 6 hours of sleep a night were making 11 times more errors in the test, each of the tests throughout the day at the end of the experiment. And those restricted to 4 hours of sleep were making 14 times more errors. Now, I've got a slide later on that looks at guys, some of the more serious impacts of sleep deprivation, but I know from my own personal experience, I'm sure you know it yourself, that if I've had a bad night of sleep, it tends to affect a number of different things that are very clear to me. First one is my typing goes to absolute pot. I'm constantly deleting stuff, retyping it. I find that if I'm reading something, I can get sort of 6-7 pages through and realise that actually I've not absorbed any of what I've just read. And the other one is my vocabulary completely diminishes. I find it really difficult to put together a coherent sentence and structure. And a lot of that will become, or other effects of that, is because this sleep deprivation affects the flow of blood to 3 areas of the brain that have a very crucial role in our attention span, our decision making, and the speed at which we adopt new information. So I'm sure you'll all agree they're fairly important components of performance. And we've also seen there are numerous studies showing that shift working obviously has additional safety and job performance decrements as well. So, as I mentioned, you know, there is a very well documented link between sleep deprivation and stress. It's no coincidence that both have been rising over the last few years. Most organisations I've spoken to have done something on stress or mental health or resilience, which I'm all for, and I think that's absolutely spot on. But, you know, is sleep something that's possibly been lost in and around that might also be able to help with those goals as well? So it's all pretty similar. So when, you know, when we're stressed, we find it more difficult to get to sleep. to fall back to sleep if we wake up in the night or early in the morning. And when we're tired, we become more irritable. We find it more difficult to cope and we become more easily stressed. So it's very easy to see how you kind of enter into a downward cycle in terms of sleep and stress. So it's all very much human nature. We've probably seen the toddler having the paddy in the supermarket aisle. It's kind of very similar with us, or hopefully fewer histrionics. You know, you get that loss of coping skills. We find it much more difficult to maintain our perspective. And what we normally regard as trivial suddenly gets elevated in performance and logic and reason up and leave, and in comes the rationality to take its place. So this is going to be a very short section, having with Marco having covered most of it. But there's one slide, I think, that is worth having a look at here. And this was done, I think it's about 5 or 6 years ago now, by the American College of Occupational and Environmental Medicine, together with the Integrated Benefits Institute. So this is all done in the US and on a US healthcare model, so not an NHS-type model. And what they found is that from a purely productivity perspective, the single greatest cost to organisations is fatigue, with sleeping problems fall. When you then factor in the medical and pharmacy costs, again, remember on a US model, then obviously fatigue is the third greatest cost to organisations with sleeping problems, fifth, with some musculoskeletal issues and depression, obviously above that. So what's always interesting when I first saw this slide is that, you know, I think, you know, going back a few years, most health and wellbeing programs were looking at things like, you know, obviously exercise, nutrition, so you got the pedometer, how many steps are you doing, you know, healthy eating lessons, people started putting calories in canteens and offices, and yeah, that's all very positive, but is that what's necessarily going to bring the best return, or is including sleep within the whole mix something that might improve the overall mix and the overall return? Marco study showed that on average we lose £2,120 per employee per annum in the UK due to sleep deprivation, and obviously that's very similar to a study done a few years back by Harvard Medical School. So as I said, here are just a few of the great many worldwide front page incidents that we've seen, either caused directly by or indirectly by sleep and fatigue. So you obviously have the Exxon Valdez and the Shengneng tanker disaster. That's one that carved a 2 kilometre hole in the Great Barrier Reef. The Herald of Free Enterprise, Selby rail crash was an example of an individual who'd made poor decisions. So they've got roughly 40 minutes of sleep before setting off on a 115-mile journey, fell asleep at the wheel, ended up on the rail line, and we know what happened after that. Things like Chernobyl, Three Mile Island, Bhopal, Challenger Space Shuttle, fatigue and sleep deprivation were very much a core component of all of those, and there's obviously a Norfolk police officer crashing through a line of Bell Labs there in the bottom corner as well. But it's not just those. We've seen huge numbers of rail accidents in the US. I'm sure we've seen those. Things like undiagnosed sleep apnea, people falling asleep, poor shift scheduling. There's actually a picture of a tube train in Chicago that's got to the end of the line at Chicago Airport, and you can see the front of the train at the top of the escalator. They've just gone into the final station and gone up the escalator. Thankfully, it was at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning and very few people were on it. But it does affect us in a great many different ways. So what we found, and I'm not going to go through all of these statistics, but just to pick out a few, I guess, that are quite interesting. So we've developed a kind of online sleep assessment, or we call it our sleep health self-assessment, with leading sleep research scientists, and we've worked with probably 15 to 20 shift working organisations and probably sort of 10 to 15 day working populations. And so a lot of results are actually pretty common across these different groups. So what we found in shift working populations, so this is primarily actually police forces. We work with 12 police forces now in the UK, and then as David said, we just started doing some work with Transport for London. We haven't necessarily factored all those figures into this just yet. But 39% of shift workers tell us that fatigue interferes with their work at least a few times a week, and 69% say a few times a month. In the populations we've studied, average workday sleep duration varies between 5 hours 58 to 6 hours 28 a night, so significantly under a healthy sleep range. An average day off sleep also varied from under 6 hours to 7 3/4 hours a night. 87% of shift workers are not obtaining the sleep that they need over a shift cycle. So we know what sleep they need to function properly, and on average what sleep they're getting over that shift cycle, and on average it tends to be frequently about an hour below a day of sleep depth. We know a significant percentage are at risk of three major sleep disorders. So that was sleep apnea, insomnia, and restless leg syndrome. But we also know a very, very small percentage of those have actually been diagnosed with those conditions. Something like sleep apnea can be absolutely debilitating, but you don't necessarily know that you've got it. And it can only be a partner often that can diagnose it, but they also have to know what the symptoms of sleep apnea are, and it's not very widely known. So 85% of shift workers do not feel as though they achieve enough sleep. So very much in line with those that aren't. We find frequently caffeine being used as a crutch to help people get through the day. So the number of people drinking five or more caffeinated drinks during a day is fairly high. And also people drinking it very close to bedtime, which obviously then has an effect on their ability to sleep. And we found that 63% of the shift workers that we've studied are either overweight or obese. So, as you'd expect, the day working populations are slightly better in terms of the results we found, but it still doesn't point to a great picture. So, in this instance, only 16%, but still quite a sizable amount, but 16% say that sleep interferes with their work activities at least a few times a week, with 40% saying it a few times a month. Average workday sleep duration, even in day working populations, is only 6 hours and 33 minutes. An average day off sleep duration is 7 hours and 37 minutes. So most populations we study, we find the average day off sleep duration to weekend will be an hour more than the workday sleep. 60% of staff that we've come across so far in day working populations would be in a risk group for insomnia, which is a bit of a concern. 79% do not feel as though they achieve enough sleep. And the three main worries that always come up with day working populations our personal worries, work worries, and people not feeling as though they have enough time. So here's good and bad practice, I guess, in tackling things like fatigue. So there are kind of lots of obvious benefits. I think we've probably covered a lot of this already. We know people are going to be safer. If people have got more energy, their work-life balance is going to be better. So if you can make a full contribution in all aspects of your life, whether it's work, home, domestic, family, social life, you're obviously going to feel a lot happier, you're going to be much more engaged, you're going to be more productive, and then obviously all the costs like absenteeism, presenteeism, and staff turnover all decrease, and obviously organisational efficiency ultimately improves. So where are organisations going wrong? And the answer is because too many people just want to find this magic bullet. So we've seen the increase in wearables in a lot of organisations, because people think it's some sort of magic bullet. Chuck on and give everyone a Fitbit, we'll get loads of data, it'll be brilliant. Not the case. You can use things, like there are lots of good things out there, free things, like you can use the network scale, you can use the Fitbit sleep quality, scheduling tools like the HSE fatigue and risk index, you've got, as you said, the wearables, ready bands, that sort of thing. And all of these sit on top of, hours of service and working time directive rules, which I'm all for, not most often because they save people from themselves, quite often or unscrupulous bosses. But there are issues with all of these sort of these tools, and they kind of assume that people are well rested, and that's not necessarily going to be the case. So we know sleep quality is poor, not just sleep duration, but sleep quality can be very poor. Sleep disorders, especially undiagnosed sleep disorders, small children, other issues in our life. So we want to try and combine the subjective tools with the objective tools, rather than trying to find a one-size-fits-all intervention. So this is kind of, I guess, what we advocate. So the first one is the awareness. So, what is the extent, impact, and causes of tiredness and fatigue in the organisation? That's actually where we started with the new business. So that sleep pod that Marco had on the screen earlier, I ran that company here in the UK for 5 years. Unfortunately, a little bit after 2008, where the market for expensive chairs dropped a little, tiny little bit. So we asked people, what do you want to know? And they go, well, we don't know if we've got an issue in our business. So we went out and said, okay, we'll build this assessment. We worked with a few scientists, put it online, then a few more scientists, then another online. Anyway, so it all works quite nicely. So basically, what is the issue, and where is the issue? And what we're doing with Transport for London is we've divided it up into a huge number of different groups. So are they on the tubes? Are they in whatever else it is? And the idea is, identify which worker groups have a particular issue, then we can start building the solutions from there. So it might be the next up is policies and procedures. So do you have them? Are they in a format that someone's actually going to read, or is it 80 pages of plain text on somewhere on the back of the website, in which case no one's ever going to read it? Is it accessible? Do people understand it? Do they actually relate to the issues in the business? So those are the pretty key obvious things to start next. Then it's about the trainer, so going across the organisation, going, you know, this is what we found, this is what we want to introduce, these are the results we expect, and this is how we're going to monitor what happens afterwards. And then you get to the intervention stage. So at that point, it is introducing. So it might be cultural. So, you know, do you have a cultural issue in the business? We know in things like construction firms, it's very much the norm that you're expected to be at a meeting at 7:30 in the morning. You might often have to drive 2 hours there. You'll probably do a full day of work and then drive 2 hours at the end of it. That's not safe, it's not productive, but that's the culture of the organisation. So looking at things like that, looking at educational interventions, not just at management level, but at staff level, let's give some people some help on information they can use to actually be better informed. And also then obviously looking, it might be a tech intervention further down the line. So something like a light therapy option, especially for people who are working underground or night shift workers and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of different things there. So that's our approach. And then you've got lots of information there. It's obviously all in your handout. So feel free to come over and say hello on LinkedIn. We've got a whole load of white papers, all free. Again, have a look through those. Download them at your leisure if you'd like to as well. Now I look forward to handing over to Rob.
Rob Elvin. I head our environmental safety and health team across Europe. Do you ask a question first, I think? You've just listened to really persuasive arguments based upon economics and frankly just good practice about why you need to take sleep into account in the workplace. But how many of you think those are enough to persuade your directors that they need to take this seriously? Or do you think they might need just a little bit more to nudge them along the way. Because my experience with health and safety over the last 25 years, if you go back 25 years, it was almost impossible to get a board of directors to take health and safety seriously. What made them take it seriously, probably in the last 7 to 10 years? The Corporate Manslaughter Act being introduced and their own fear of their own liberty going, well, losing it. But sometimes, notwithstanding great economic and social argument, which is what we've heard, you also need a bit of a legal threat to make people change their approach. So, I often get brought in to add to that legal threat. I'm usually the sort of guy who actually organisations don't want to have to phone, because if they do need to phone me, it normally means they've done something very wrong and they've got some regulator breathing down their neck. Anyway, sometimes I say a little bit of fear can help you move a good agenda forward. So, from the legal perspective, what I'm going to do, I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the impact of sleep or lack of sleep and fatigue, because you've heard really good arguments already. I am going to focus really about what does the law mean? What does the law require in terms of consideration around sleep and fatigue? It is broader than sleep, it's fatigue that I will sort of take into account. I'll talk about a little bit about some of the consequences for employers and employees if they don't take this seriously and don't manage it properly from the legal perspective. And I'll come up with some, from my perspective, what I'll call reasonably practicable steps that organisations might well be needing to think about in order to comply with the law. So, you heard those stats, etc. already. There's some more. It is undeniable that workers who are not getting enough sleep and or suffering from fatigue create a greater risk in the workplace. You've heard already, you can't do your job as well as you should be able to do it if you have not had sufficient sleep, if you are suffering from fatigue and other sleep deprivation related conditions such as irritability, giddiness, lightheadedness, etc., etc. These all impact upon how you do your job, and therefore they have to have a prospect of creating a greater risk in the workplace. Accidents on the road are probably the easiest example, because the most tangible, because we know so many accidents are caused by drivers who are tired. Okay? Now, you can see a stat there of how much that costs the UK each year. Significant amount. You've also seen earlier some of these examples around the disasters. There's a whole list, a very long list of tragic disasters where one of the causal factors has been tiredness. Okay? From my own practice, probably one in four prosecutions that I'm asked to help with, defend, etc., there is a question mark over whether a cause was overwork, tiredness, fatigue, etc. On numerous occasions, I've had to look at working time documentation, shift patterns, how hard was a company making its employees work? Because the regulators, the HSE, know it's a factor. So they look at it in many, many investigations. That alone should be a red flag for you. If the regulators are already attending accident investigations, thinking there may be an issue around how hard someone is working or whether they've had sufficient rest, sleep, etc., then you know it's something that you should be managing to preempt and to address it. So, as I say, most of the serious accidents I deal with, there will be an issue around someone being overworked, somebody having the wrong shift patterns, fatigue, tiredness, etc., etc. Okay? And it's every workplace. Now, clearly, some workplaces, some working environments will suffer from a higher degree of risk if its people are tired or fatigued. Okay, so people involved in construction, manufacturing, higher risk industries, transportation. You can see, it's obvious, isn't it, that if you're tired and you're a worker in one of those industries, you have the ability to create greater risk through your tiredness. But we also see in other lower risk sectors, you know, if I am quite tired today, I will not do my job this afternoon as well as I would if I was less tired. But I'm probably not going to harm anybody. Because, well, I might fall into my own computer and burn the forehead. But that's about it. But if I was responsible for a manufacturing process or the like, then obviously I can create a greater risk. And that's a key point which I'll come on to in a while. You have to look at this subject from the perspective of your organisation, because you have to look at each risk profile and how it will be affected by the issue of tiredness, lack of sleep, fatigue, etc. Okay? So it depends industry to industry, the degree of risk that we're talking about here, but there's no such thing as no risk. Okay? You may be low risk, but you're never no risk. It's something I often say to lower risk sector boards of directors. As an aside, Japanese, they're great at these sorts of things and creating initiatives to address work processes. They have a concept called karoshi, death from overwork. I regularly use this, but my line manager asked me or adds a yet another area of responsibility to me. I just quote karoshi, and because it's Japanese, she backs off. It must be right, it must be valuable. But if there's a concept about death from overwork, you take it seriously. Regulators are beginning to look closer at well-being, and sleep and fatigue and tiredness is part of well-being. Okay? Mental health is being looked at far more closely by the Health and Safety Executive than ever before. Okay, so this is all part of a movement, I think, in this country and elsewhere, where well-being, tiredness, fatigue, mental health, they're all being looked at. Not least because of all the economic arguments that you've heard. This country suffers from productivity issues. Okay? So if you become more productive by dealing with the sleep challenge, for example, that's good for the country. But the HSE are also looking at it
from the accident prevention perspective and the regulatory compliance perspective as well. So you need to be following and tracking some of the initiatives, some of the guidance, etc., that has begun to come from the HSC, for example, and I think will increase in volume and number and focus there. So that's the first of my warnings, really. The regulators are onto it and looking at it. They're reading and learning from research from others and beginning to filter their own thoughts, guidance, etc., into our workplace, and you need to be on top of that. But what does the law actually say? Well, you won't find much law which is prescriptive about what you as an employer have to do with regards to sleep and tiredness. There's some, I'll find it, but not much. And generally speaking, you probably understand the health and safety law in the UK is essentially governed by a legal framework where at its core are general duties, okay, which are dotted in, they're right in the middle of the slide, frankly. So although you might have employment law, rather prescriptive about working time, that's one of those examples where there is some prescription, the health and safety law starts really with your duty as an employer to conduct your undertaking so far as it is reasonably practical not to expose your employees to risk. And there's a corresponding duty virtually the same with regards to non-employees. What does that mean? You need to do all that is reasonably practicable to avoid your employees and those affected by your undertaking from being exposed to risks to their health, safety and welfare. So, for example, if it is foreseeable that your employees will suffer from fatigue or tiredness because of what they do in their job, that's a risk which you need to address because it is foreseeable. Okay, and you have to consider what the reasonably practicable steps are to bring that risk down to its lowest possible acceptable level. Okay, so that's why there is a legal duty with regards to sleep, tiredness. It's not that you have to look at how much sleep is my employee getting at home. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is you have to be aware that your work and or your workers may not have enough sleep. You need to be sufficiently alive to that to spot it. I'll come back to that because that's an educational issue. And you need to be assessing the risk to your workplace, to your employees and to others affected by you if your workers are suffering from a lack of sleep, tiredness and fatigue. So there is a duty, albeit generally, which applies to this concept of sleep, tiredness, and fatigue. You also know that there's a duty to risk assess. It's under the management regulations, regulation 3. I'm not saying, again, you have to risk assess sleep. What I am saying is that in your general risk assessment with regards to your workplaces and your employees, fatigue, tiredness is a risk you need to consider as part of the general risk assessment. So, for example, if there is, we're dealing with a manufacturing facility and you have risk assessments covering the manufacturing processes, I would say that one of the risks that you may have in that risk assessment around the process is what would happen if the employee conducting the process is suffering from fatigue. Okay, that's how it factors into the risk assessment. Not necessarily a bespoke lack of sleep risk assessment, but as an issue of risk within the general risk assessment process. And I don't see in risk assessments that I have to look at fatigue considered as often as it should be. So you might have a risk assessment covering warehouse activities, which will cover working at height, which will cover slipping on fluids, spilt, but which won't cover fatigue, tiredness of employee, even though warehouses often run on shifts. And that's an area, I think, which generally I see lacking, but one that can be addressed by their application, actually, of health and safety management. Okay? So there is a root duty, I think, to consider tiredness and lack of sleep within risk assessment, Risk assessment is a foundation of legal duties for health and safety law in the UK, and it is all founded by the fact that it's foreseeable. And all the research just even makes it more foreseeable, and therefore more of an issue you have to take into account. Okay? So it's not one which is a nice to have. It's not just about you'll be more productive, make more money if you follow good practice. It's and you'll be compliant with the law if you follow this practice. Okay? Shift work, which was touched upon earlier, is an area where there is a bit more prescription, not necessarily in the law, but certainly in guidance, which is just why I wanted to flag it. Okay? And it's in some respects obvious that there'd be guidance around shift work because the risks of things going wrong when people work at night and unusual shifts, I think we all understand those risks can be increased again for all the reasons you've already heard about. So I'm not going to go through what the particular guidance says. I just want to make you aware of that if you are employers who have shift workers, particularly shifts falling outside this, what they call the standard daytime hours, which is 7 to 7, okay, then there is HSC guidance setting out things that you should do and consider so that it's done safely. Okay, so it talks about rotating hours of work. It, you know, it deals with looking at how you arrange the shifts, etc. Okay, so just be aware of that. Go back. There it is. In the middle of this particular guide about shift work, I think is a really important legal point. Health and safety law in the UK is often seen as what duties fall upon the employer. But there is a obligation on every single employee to carry out their job with reasonable care so they don't expose themselves or others to risk. Okay? Often forgotten, frankly, that every employee has their own legal duty, and in fact, breach of that duty is a criminal offence, and an employee can be prosecuted if they breach that duty. Most of you will have health and safety policies in your workplace. They will probably make reference to the duties of an employer under Section 2 and 3 of the Health and Safety Work Act, which I referred to earlier. They probably also make reference to Section 7. I think it's really important for employers to educate their employees about their own responsibility for their sleep, because to an extent, they have greater control over that than the employer, because they are the ones at home who go to sleep. You know, they are the ones who, within, obviously, all of us have life challenges, but they have the ability to put the laptop down or put the iPad down to go to sleep and get a good night's sleep so that when they come into work, they are in a decent state to do work. And that's why I think educational programs are really important. And I would argue part of your legal duty as an employer to comply with general health and safety laws. I think it's incumbent upon employers to be educating employees about the benefits of sleep and the risks of not getting enough, and sharing the responsibility around making sure people get enough sleep. Okay, so I think that's part of the legal obligation, but it can be flipped towards, you know, employees, you also have a legal duty around this area. Reference was made to the HSC's fatigue and risk index earlier. I just wanted to flag it as part of the legal duties around shift work and how you control it. It's not an appropriate tool, I think, for daytime working, as far as I understand. But again, another point about regulators. If they go to the time and trouble of issuing guidance and or creating tools to allow you to deal with a risk which they say is a workplace, work-related risk, and you ignore it or are ignorant of them, if something goes wrong, they won't give you the benefit of the doubt. So that's, again, another reason really why being on top of guidance, being on top of available tools, particularly from your regulator, is important if you ever wanted to argue you took all reasonably practical steps to comply with health and safety law. in this area of fatigue, sleep, and its impact on a safe or unsafe workplace. I should say that since the Corporate Manslaughter Act was introduced, the judge, in a corporate manslaughter trial, the judge has a standard set of directions that he gives to a jury before they deliberate. And one of the things that he asks, or she asks the jury to look at, is whether or not the corporate defendant has followed available guidance. Again, and that has sort of elevated the importance of guidance in health and safety law in more recent years. So, if there is an incident in the workplace, a health and safety related accident, and it's related to tiredness or sleep or fatigue, it clearly can be health, it clearly can be liability. We've seen criminal prosecutions brought. So the Selby train crash, for example, I think the guy was called Hart. I think he got, from recollection, 10 or 12 years sentence. He wouldn't serve all that, but I think that it was a pretty significant prison sentence. Now, had he been an employee, he wasn't, but had he been an employee and he'd been asked to make the same journey and his employer had some understanding that maybe Mr. Hart hadn't been sleeping enough, maybe because the day before they'd sent him to a different part of the country, then not only would Mr. Hart have been prosecuted, but the corporate entity, his employer, may have also been prosecuted. Okay? And that is what is very closely scrutinised in some of these large-scale disasters. But not just those. I want to make it clear, it's not just the big cases where the HSE and the police scrutinise whether tiredness and sleep, etc., have caused the accident, but in many other workplace incidents and accidents throughout the country, they dive into it. And you can suffer as an employee, potential criminal prosecution, civil case, civil personal injury case from an employee who's harmed as a result of the company not dealing with fatigue-related, sleep-related issues. I should point out, I think Marcus might have mentioned it earlier, suicide, work-related suicides are increasing in this country and elsewhere. We've got a lot of study around this area, particularly in France. We were recently giving a seminar on this subject. But the sleep deprivation is, as you've heard, often linked to suicide. Workplace and work-related suicides are on the increase. Coroner's inquests are regularly looking at why someone has committed suicide to see whether or not there are work-related pressures that have contributed. And so this whole, I suppose, net of scrutiny is very much increasing in this country. And this is one of the topics I can see being given greater focus on by regulators in the future. So the whole raft of ways the law can enforce against an employer who hasn't managed the risk or the risks around sleep deprivation with its workforce. Okay? So what do you do? Well, you've already heard some of the things that are available, some of the management tools and techniques which organisations might look at. From my perspective as a lawyer, I would say you need to be trying to do what is reasonably practicable, because that's what the general duties require of you. What is reasonably practicable will develop over time. That's why I keep saying you need to be on top of what the guidance is saying, and maybe also what the research is saying. But you do need to factor it, sleep, lack of sleep, etc., into the relevant risk assessments that you might already have in your workplace. You do need to factor them into, for example, transport policies, providing guidance to your workforce if numbers of your workforce do a lot of driving. It's a key area where that needs to be considered. You need tools to address the risk so that your people aren't driving when they shouldn't because they're tired, or aren't driving for too long a period because that makes them tired, because we know that creates greater risk. So some of your policy work needs to take into account the concept on the risk around lack of sleep. Shift work, you need to have a plan to deal with that. That's consistent with the HSE guidance. That may therefore require you to use the HSE's tool around fatigue and risk, or alternatively, use other tools that may be available, which may be more suitable. You've got to be available, you've got to be aware of what those tools are. So there is a research and learning element to what I say is a reasonably practical response to this relevant risk. And then you need to be ensuring that your line managers can spot the red flags with their teams. Because I think employers need to be aware of the fact that people might come into the workplace having not had enough sleep. That's a foreseeable risk. But you won't spot that unless you're looking for it. So I think it's incumbent upon an organisation that's taken all reasonably practical steps to have trained its line managers and its management team in understanding the risks and being able to have the tools, etc., to recognise when those risks might be manifesting so that they can then introduce management controls to address the risk and again bring that risk down to an acceptable level. So those are some of the things I think that the law would require you to look at. As technology develops, etc., and practice develops, we've heard about loads of things, and we can't spell, because we're too tired at the end of our presentation. We've got fatigue maps spelled incorrectly. But some of these concepts, I was sitting there thinking, if I was to walk into a manufacturing facility in Accrington, in Lancashire, and to say to the owner manager, CEO, you need a sleeping pod. I am not so sure that's an easy sell, okay? But in time it might be. If I tell him it's going to make your workforce more productive, he's not going to buy it. If I tell him about what it's like, not that I know, but what I hear about being prosecuted for manslaughter because of a workplace fatality and how a sleeping pod might just be all he needs to have an argument against the HSC about tiredness in the workforce, that might begin to get him interested. Anyway, today he might not buy the concept of a sleep pod, but in time these things are going to become more familiar, more acceptable, and whether they're reasonably practical, that will change as well. Essentially, they will become reasonably practical. I think arguably, scientific argument might still need to be developed before a jury will say, yes, those are steps that should have been taken, but without doubt, in 20 years' time, they'll be very prevalent. At some point between now and then, they are going to be reasonably practical, and so therefore, I do think you need to be taking into account or considering whether they are suitable for the risk reduction techniques that you are going to be introducing. Things like fatigue maps, for example, which I didn't know very much about, but you wouldn't really, when you're sat on your backside in an office all day. But fatigue mats apparently just make it a lot better for people who stand on hard floors during the day. They're pretty cheap. The cheaper a control measure is, the more reasonably practical it is, the more the HSC will say, well, you should have them. But little things like that are going to play a part in your risk control measures, I think, in time around sleep and fatigue. Okay, of course, working from home is the answer to everything, I'm told. So those are just a few things about, the law does require you to take this seriously, and if you don't, depending on what might happen, there can be some serious consequences, and there are actually some good areas of guidance, research, and I suppose advice, which allows you to take this issue and control the risk in compliance with the law. Thank you.
Well, thank you to everyone, first of all. As I said, it's quite interesting because we've got a really diverse range of attendees today. We've got people from advertising, marketing, professional services, construction, retail, infrastructure, hotels. This is clearly something which is on everyone's radar. And as Rob and Marcus have alluded to, I think it is important because it isn't just looking at a manufacturing issue, an infrastructure issue.
it isn't just the productivity. You have got the Karoshi concept in Japan. There have been, there's an advertising firm in Japan that has actually, if I remember correctly, had to change its working practices because they have had people die. There was a banker in London 2 years ago who was working, I can't remember which bank he was working at, but he was up for 72 hours straight and then died. So this isn't a remote concept. This isn't just certain industries. It is across everything. One small point, because, you know, it's 2018. We're 3 months away from the 25th of May, 2018. No, we're 2.5 months away. I can't even do math. I must be tired this morning. And as you will all know, the GDPR comes in on the 25th of May. Guaranteed to put a smile on everyone's face. Just a tiny point, that if you do track people's sleep, if you issue people with wearables and you do monitor their sleep, that is something that under the GDPR, I mean, everything comes within the GDPR, not that it's remotely challenging for us all, but that is something that if you are collecting that data, you will need to think about, or if you do it in the future, you will need to think about. Now, who has any questions for any of our panel members? If you do, please stick your hand up, shout them out, one at the back.
Just a quick question for Marcus. I'm a bit surprised by the discrepancy between the fact that 85% of first-ranking women regularly feel tired, and the fact that 16% of staff say fatigue interferes with daily work. So I wonder whether the workplace is sort of men in denial.
It is. This is the absolute truth. Yes, it is. So if you look at the figures in terms of sleep duration, and then you look at the figures in terms of people saying to what extent it interferes with their work, there's an almighty gap between the actual reality of what people feel and what the stats and what the science says. And I think there's a... Increasingly, recently, I'm seeing a fact that people accept whatever sleep they get as it's a given. Right? So people... I did a couple of sessions up at Staffordshire Police recently, and they had a mixed audience of shift workers and office workers. And people, until we ran that session, didn't think that there was an awful lot that they could do about it. They're like, right, I sleep badly. Yeah, that is what it is. You accept a new level of normal. And you don't recall what it was like when you were well-rested and how much more productive, happier, you know, run around the garden with the kids. So I think there is a massive disconnect between what science would suggest your capabilities are and what people understand their own capabilities to be if they're in that state.
But just to that point, within this project that we run, Britain's Healthiest Workplace, and together with Vitality Health, we ask people how long you sleep, so they get their self-reported sleep duration, but then, because Vitality has this Vitality Health program where they have wearables and so on, and they actually get also data on the actual amount of sleep, and it's very interesting that for men, they usually tend to self-report that they sleep way more than they actually sleep, whereas for women, it's almost it's kind of aligned. So it kind of feeds back to this point.
I think that feeds into a lot of the issues that most people in the room will deal with. That even if you look at mental health, for example, people will outwardly say they're fine. They will say they're sleeping enough. They'll say they're eating well. They'll say they're definitely not drinking more than 6 units a week. And yet they are doing all of those things. So I think it's the outward appearance that people want to present.
So I was going to say, similar to what we've just been talking about, if they're in the study, so you look at quality of sleep and quantity, so at the moment everything's talking about below 6 hours, below 7 hours, is that completely undisturbed? Is that deep sleep? You know, where's the quality versus quantity?
I mean, it's both. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, it's definitely both. They obviously correlate with each other quite heavily. In our study, we looked only at sleep duration because data on sleep quality is only emerging now with all the kind of variables and so on, which becomes way more, let's say, detailed and more kind of, you know, better data available. Right now, we only look at sleep duration, but it's definitely both. So, for instance, we know, again, from data and self-reported data mainly, that women tend to sleep a bit less than men. No, or the other way around, men sleep less than women. But the quality of sleep is for women tends to be less. I mean, so again, self-reported, but again, with more and more technology and all the devices that we get, we might see differences from that.
Yeah, quality is equally if not more important than the quantity. So you can have, even if, for instance, you might get 4.5 hours of sleep a night, if that's all in one continuous, you know, period, that is going to be better than someone with something like sleep apnea that's sleeping 10 hours a night, who is basically waking up potentially 100 times an hour, who is getting absolutely no quality of sleep at all. So, yes.
But at the same time, only 2 hours and very good quality is not enough.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. Well, I'm not saying 4.5 hours is enough, no, but it could be better potentially than someone getting 10 hours. So, yeah, you need to be careful with the metric.
And I was reading something this morning on the way in about the difference between wearables track effectively your movement, they can listen to you in your sleep, which I find a little bit creepy. But they can tell if you're muttering in your sleep, if you've got sleep apnea, that sort of thing. And so that is a measure of quality of sleep. Over to you guys, you're the experts. But the report I was reading said actually, to do a proper qualitative measure of how well people sleep, you need to start measuring brain waves, brain activity, and all of those sorts of things. So I think we're probably a long way off being able to actually measure true quality sleep.
We're getting better.
Yeah.
And there's some wearables now available that start tracking your brain waves at night. It's not as comfortable to wear at night.
Sorry, as you can see from my face, that makes me feel very, very happy.
Yeah. My biggest issue with wearables, there's two things. So they can be a force for good in people with someone with sleep issues, especially if they've got insomnia, and they go, oh, I only get 2 hours of sleep a night, and then they chuck this on, and they realize, actually, you get 4 or 5 hours of sleep a night. And it can be very helpful in reducing the anxiety that goes with insomnia. But it can also have exactly the opposite effect to someone that's otherwise getting a perfectly decent amount of sleep, and then suddenly goes, panic, I'm getting 3 hours of sleep. That's because the wearable's like completely off. And then they induces a level of anxiety and panic around sleep. So there is a lawsuit in the US against Fitbit for its sleep tracking capabilities, and they are hoping to produce a wearable that will be able to diagnose sleep apnea at some point in the near future. So it looks like they've got an awful big leap to make before they get to that point. But, as Marcus said, they are starting to get better. I was chatting to a guy in India the other day who's developed a sensor that goes underneath the mattress that monitors heart rhythms, breathing rates, not just movement. So people are getting closer to something that's a bit more clinic grade.
Any other questions?
I noticed half of us are woken 6 times a night by our partners.
During the week, I sleep in a different room to my wife. She thought normally it's the other way around. So actually genuinely it works quite well for us. We're completely different. She's a morning person, I'm an evening person. And so for during the week it works better for us to sleep in different rooms. But other things you can do, different duvet covers, so women and men have different optimum sleeping temperatures. Women it's much higher, so men will often wake up without a duvet cover, especially in winter. And lots of other sort of things like that you can put in place.
And that is a whole market out there.
There is.
Be clear, we only give legal advice, not medical advice.
Likewise.
Anything else from anyone? No, well, thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much to our panel. We will be hanging around for a few minutes afterwards, so come say hi, come ask us any other questions. Otherwise, have a safe journey home.
Thank you.
Thank you.